Okay, well, welcome to the Enneagram. We're going to be together for the better part of 9 weeks trying to figure out what this is and who you are as far as the Enneagram is concerned. So let me just see a show of hands. How many of you pretty much know what your number is and have researched this? Okay, several of you. Okay, well, if you'll forgive me, we are going to kind of start from scratch. So if you already know your number and you're absolutely sure, then just kind of roll with it. And if you know your number, but you're not really sure that's your right number or you want to rethink this, if you really hate the number that you think you are, that's probably your number, I hate to tell you. But maybe it's not, so this will give you a chance to relook at what you've thought you knew. So the Enneagram, and this is by way of introduction this morning, and we'll do a little exercise to try to, a couple of exercises to try to pin down what number you might be so that over the next weeks when we kind of open up each of those numbers, you'll be able to learn more about your number. But I would encourage you to listen to all the numbers because it's helpful to know what your spouse or your children or your parent might be. It might help you deal with them if you understand where they're coming from. So it helps me anyway to know what my family might be. So the Enneagram. The word Enneagram comes from two Greek words, ennea meaning nine and gram meaning points. So an Enneagram is simply a circle inscribed by 9 points, much simpler than the word might give you thought it might be. So it's an Enneagram. An Enneagon is a nine-sided figure. So an Enneagram is a circle with 9 points. Ben Franklin once said, there are three things that are very hard: steel, a diamond, and to know thyself. And probably knowing thyself is harder even than the other two. And so the Enneagram is just one of those ways that we might come to know ourselves. It's a vehicle. It's a tool. It's not the be-all and end-all. It's not the answer to all our problems. It's not the final word. Oh, please come in. We're going to need to get more chairs. Do you know where they might be? Thank you, Anne. But there are chairs here, so come on. Are there any in the closet? No? Okay. Anne's gone to gather them. There's a chair here. There's a chair up here. You're going to have to come to the front. Okay, so the Enneagram is a tool for knowing yourself. When you know the Enneagram, you might be able to let yourself off the hook a little bit for why you do what you do and those things that you wish you didn't do. You might say, well, at least I know why I do them. Other people might not make you quite so crazy if you understand where they might be coming from. You can possibly stop banging your head against a wall for things that are going on around you or things going on inside of you. And it is, I believe, a great path for spiritual growth and transformation. I have used it that way for myself, and I use it in spiritual direction with people, and it really does touch a lot of what God wants us to know, I believe. So why study it? Because we want to know what makes ourselves tick, because we want to understand others, especially those that we interact with a lot. We want to be more flexible and resilient. We want to not just act on autopilot all the time, but we want to be able to choose our behaviors and our responses, and this can help us do that. And we want to help others to understand themselves. And we have a desire to see the image of God that is in me. And the image of God is in each of you. You know that. And this will just help you understand maybe a little more why you are the way you are and what God might have intended when God made you your way. Carl Jung once described the personality as the social face that we use when we want to present ourselves to the world. He said, to make a definite impression on the other and to conceal the true nature of the individual. That's our persona. It's that we put forward when we're in a group, when we want to be impressive or we want to be safe. We put forth our personality, our persona, and make an impression that is that we mean to make. Okay, so does everybody get that kind of, yeah? Okay. So What is our personality or our persona? It's the way we view reality. One of the things I found very helpful with the Enneagram is that I began to realize in ways I hadn't perhaps before that the way I see things is not the way my spouse sees things. It's not the way my colleagues see things. We see things differently. We have different perspective, a different lens on which we see the world. So not everybody responds to a sunrise the way I respond to it. And not everybody responds to a political issue the way I respond to it. Because we have different viewpoints, different basic views of reality. And our personality is also how we defend ourselves, how we keep ourselves safe, how we protect ourselves from all those things that are coming in at us and maybe making us uncomfortable. Richard Rohr talks a lot about the false self. And the false self has a lot to do with our Enneagram number. We'll get into that a little bit more later. But he says that every one of us begins with our own divine DNA. I call it the spark of God that's in each of us. It's our imago Dei, the way we image God. And our false self, or our personality, or you could use the word ego, there's a lot of words to describe this. The false self is that part of us that has lost touch with our imago Dei. We've lost touch with that part of God, that divine spark that is within us. And so the agenda of that false self is to look good, to give that good persona out. You know, maybe, that you are maybe living out of your false self if you find that something makes you offended easily. If you're at a meeting and someone says something and you get offended by it or you want to react to it in an angry way, you might be living out of your false self at that moment, because whatever they did or said might be attacking not your true self, but that personality, that ego, that protective shell that you've created to keep yourself safe and feel secure. What we call sin, Rohr would say, are actually symptoms of our illusion, and it is only an illusion that we're separated from God. So the more we embrace our imago Dei, our spark of God within ourselves, the more we can know that we're not separated from God, the more we can choose to live as God would have us live, and the more we can see that image also in the other and see that other person as also imaging God in their own very unique way. So the Enneagram helps us peel away, like an onion, peel away the layers of our false self, one layer at a time, sometimes over many years, depending upon how deep that ego has been built, how much protection we've felt we needed. But we peel away the layers of the false self, that ego, that personality, that mask that we have built over time to cover up and thus distort the image of God that's in us. Any thoughts or questions before we move on from this idea of the false self? It's a key component to understanding why the Enneagram helps us grow spiritually. It's not just a fun tool to know, you know, why my husband annoys me when he does that or this, or why I annoy him when I do this or that. It also can help us truly grow in our relationship with God and with others. Saint Irenaeus said, "The glory of God is the human fully alive." The human who is fully alive is that one who is fully in touch with the image of God that is within him or her. And Saint Augustine said, "You created us in your image, O God, and our hearts will not rest until we rest in you." So again, the Enneagram is that tool to help us get to where our hearts are at rest. Our true selves are at rest in the true love of God within us. So the Enneagram represents 9 different ways that humanity has learned to cope with the perceived loss of connection with the divine. We never lose our connection with the divine. I'm going to fix that particular screen. But we don't lose our connection, but we may feel like we're separated from God. We may feel like God's far away. We always say, if God feels far away, who moved? We did, right? But we can feel we've lost that connection, and the Enneagram can help us find it again. The Enneagram can help bring us back because it helps us see where we've lost the connection, what that connection was, and how we can get it back, all three. So that's the theory behind the Enneagram. God has given us a gift. Each Enneagram number represents a gift, a special way that that number images God, so that gift that God has given us. Each Enneagram number also speaks to our compulsion or our addiction, because when that gift gets out of whack, it almost becomes an addiction or a compulsion. We want to use that gift over and over again in ways that maybe we're not meant to use it, and so we get addicted to it, and it starts to take over, and it starts to become that ego mask that we put on to protect ourselves, and we lose, it becomes distorted, the gift gets distorted. And then there is the grace, God's grace, to help us uncover what's going on, look at that that compulsion that has distorted our gift, and bring us back to living that gift again as it was meant by God to be lived. Not out of a compulsive sense of defending, but out of a sense of the beauty that we were meant to be. So some people will say about the Enneagram, about the Myers-Briggs, about all those personality tests that you can take, I don't want to be put in a box. I don't want you to tell me that I'm this number or I'm INFP or EO, whatever. I just want to be me. But I would respond, and the Enneagram would respond, that you're already in a box. Your personality is the box that's keeping you from being who you were meant to be. And the Enneagram is a way of showing you how to get out of that box. We're already trapped in the box of our personality because we act on that automatically without even thinking. And the Enneagram helps us see it and choose differently if we need to and want to. So I think it helps us get out of the box. It doesn't put us in one. So as we've said, each of these nine types has its own way of imaging God, its own way of relating to other people, its own point of view, its own perceptions, its own preoccupations, and its own values and approaches to life. Each of the nine types relates to others in different but understandable ways. And you can see that the nine numbers are around the outside of the circle, but there's all kinds of lines connecting the different numbers. So while you may predominantly be one number, you're never that number and that number alone. There are other influences around the circle that make you unique. So two people who say, I'm a seven, can be not anything alike because of other numbers and other things that are affecting them. We'll get into all that as the weeks go on. Each of the nine types shows us that each of us bring value to the world. We have strengths and we have weaknesses. Every type has its strengths. Every type has its shadow side, that compulsive side. And no one type is better than another. And I don't know anybody that hasn't wished at one point or another that they were some other number. And they keep taking tests to try to prove that they are that number because that's what number they really want to be. The person who is that number is doing the same thing, wanting to be your number. Because we always think the grass is greener, right? We always think that somebody else has it together and we don't. So one of the beauties of this is just to recognize that we're all messy, right? We're all messy. And some of us may look better than others and have a better exterior, but inside, we're all dealing with something. And maybe that helps us just have a little more grace for each other because nobody has it together. So no one type is better than another. The thing I love most about the Enneagram, I guess, is it gets to motivation. It doesn't just tell us what we do, but it tries to get at the why we do it. What are we trying to accomplish when we do this behavior or we say this thing? Because there's a reason behind it. And it's a reason that goes back to our early childhood. Enneagram theory is that we come into the world with a number, which is our way of looking at life, our perception of what life is. But then, as life happens to us, we respond to that from our point of view, from our way of seeing. And we are motivated to feel whole, to feel okay, to feel like we're going to make it by responding in ways to that stimulus that comes into us from outside. And so the Enneagram helps us get at that early motivation for why we do what we do, and maybe why others do what they do, so that we can see that two people could do the same behavior, but do that behavior for two very different reasons. And those reasons are what really helps us make a change when we understand what those are. I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate, I do. Anyone know where that quote comes from? Paul, you all know. Yes, it's in Romans 7:15. If only Paul had known the Enneagram, I think he would have had an answer to that, and he wouldn't have had to write that, right? But see, even Paul had that problem that he didn't know why he does things, right? He didn't know why he wanted to do this, but he didn't. And he didn't want to do that, and that's what he did. And of course, that would be called sin, maybe, by some. Anybody ever have that experience that Paul had? I know I do. Probably every day, you know, like that prayer, thank you, God, that I didn't do anything wrong today. Now I'm going to get out of bed and start the day, so please help me. You know, that's kind of where I think that comes from. So, what's your number? I'd like to do a little 30-second, and I'm going to time it, experience to help you figure that out. I get my timer going. Not 30 minutes. 30 seconds. And here's your instructions on what to do. Get comfortable in your chair. Sit any way you'd like. You might want to close your eyes for this. And I want for 30 seconds for you to sit there and think absolutely nothing. Just close your eyes, get comfortable, and think absolutely nothing for 30 seconds, starting now. Okay, time is up. All right. Now I'm going to pass some papers out. And on these papers are several ways that you may have responded deep down inside to that experience. And we all had different ways of responding to what I just asked you to do. So I'd ask you to take a few minutes, read through these paragraphs that describe different reactions to that little experiment, those 30 seconds, and maybe circle or jot down or just remember three of them that kind of come close. Remember, they're not going to be perfect, but you're going to say, yeah, that's kind of how I felt, or yeah, that's what I did, and see which of those, if any, but maybe you'll see three that do fit with what you experienced. And I had 30, so there may not be enough. If you're with someone that you like a lot, maybe you could share. Or maybe you just don't like them. Anybody need a pen or a marker of some kind to mark down what you thought? Anybody else?
Thank you.
Uh-huh. We need a Barbara?
Okay, pick one.
Barbara needs one. Everybody have one or have one to share? Okay. Thank you. There's still some more. If you're sharing, I've got extras, so. All right. If you need to keep working, that's fine. I'm gonna go on. And I'm not going to tell you what your number is yet. So put that aside. We're going to do something else first, and then we'll come back to that before the time ends, I hope. Okay, so there's other ways to figure out what our number is. One of those is to look at some triads that kind of capture different aspects of number groupings and see which ones of those fit, and then look at how those groupings bring us to a number. Okay, so we're going to do that exercise right now. First, I need to tell you what those triads are. The first one is the Hornavian triad, named for Karen Horney, who came up with this idea that we all have a go-to social style to get our needs met. Think of when you are in a group, maybe you're at a party, or maybe you're at a meeting at work, but we have a characteristic attitude or posture that we go to habitually to get our needs met in those places. And this is not something that we think about. This is when we're on autopilot. This is when we're responding to a situation just out of our, this is how I do it, and we're not even thinking about it. Okay, you get uncomfortable at a cocktail party, maybe. Maybe you don't like those, or maybe you do like them, but you have a style of how you enter that experience. You have a way of being when you go to a St. Elizabeth's dinner or when you go to a parish council meeting or if you're on vestry. You have a way of entering that situation. And this is what we're talking about, okay? So there's three, she said, three social styles. We either move against people, and that's not necessarily negative, so don't take that as negative. We move toward people, dutiful, or we're withdrawn, we move away from people. So we're either assertive, dutiful, or withdrawn. Now, we may be all of those three in different times of our life or in different circumstances, but there's one probably that we do more often than the others. So that's what I want you to think of, okay? So if you are an active or an assertive type, you're an initiator. You're decisive. You reach out to make things happen. You push your energy out. You tend to be goal-oriented. You look for options. You have an all or nothing approach. We're going to do this. We're going to get it done. I'm going to move in there and make it happen. It's kind of the assertive approach to life, to your social interactions. So for the assertive, it's a fight or flight. This is the fight mentality, moving against. You tend to initiate action. You tend to be adventurous and direct, take charge when it needs to happen. You can be spontaneous, future-oriented, you're enthusiastic and confident, you're influential in the groups that you join, you're optimistic, you believe it's going to be good, it's going to work out. You can get a little impatient when everybody doesn't get right on board. Okay, that may describe some of you in the room. Not everything on that is going to be you, but you may see a lot of you in some of those adjectives. Okay, or you may be more the dutiful, compliant type. These are people who earn their right to get their needs met by doing for others. Your response to stress or uncomfortable situations is to try to determine what's the right thing to do here. What do I need to do? How can I be of service to other people in this place? Who needs a new cup of coffee? Who needs a chair? Who needs something that I can help with? How can I accommodate the greater good? You want to be dependable and responsible and loyal. Your energy is directed towards others, not towards the task, like the assertive, but towards other people. You're always there to help. You're willing to take one for the team, and you're devoted to a cause. So some adjectives that might describe you as submissive, balanced, responsible, accepting. You take your obligations seriously. You worry about the details of what's going on. It's not the big picture for you, it's the details that matter. You accommodate other people. You might be a little cautious, persistent in getting things done. You tend to be prepared and always agreeable. That sounds like you. You might have a dutiful, compliant social stance. Or you might be the withdrawn type, where to get your needs met, you don't go after people, you don't go towards people, you withdraw. Either physically, you leave that party because you don't want to be there, so the first chance you get, you're home. Or you just emotionally withdraw. emotionally disengaged. You're the person who takes in information before you give it out. You tend to be easygoing, and you're often the glue that keeps the organization together. You can tend to be cynical or iconoclastic if you're put on the defensive. And often you clam up and don't say much of anything when you're under stress. Some adjectives for the withdrawn stance: while assertives are the fight, you're the flight. You tend to be composed and creative, reflective, detached, maybe a little pessimistic. This is not going well. This doesn't feel good. How do I get out of here? You may be preoccupied, resigned to what you have to do, and you're just going to do it and hope it goes away. You may procrastinate some in order to help it go away. You may be a little stubborn and inflexible, imaginative, unpredictable. You're solitary, you kind of go on your own, and you might be very insightful, although you may not express it to other people. You may know what the right answer is, but you keep it to yourself. So, some famous people might have been assertive. Teddy Roosevelt, Oprah Winfrey, and Jim Carrey might be the assertive type. We don't know, because we don't know what motivates them. So this is just from their exterior behaviors. Dutiful compliance stance, the do for others, Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Woody Allen. I don't know enough about Woody Allen to know why he's in there. And if you're under 40, you may not even know who the heck Woody Allen is, so that's okay. The withdrawn stance might be the Dalai Lama, Jackie Kennedy, Georgia O'Keeffe. So, which one are you? Which one do you tend to be most of the time? Not all the time. But what's your automatic response to things? You may think about it and decide to do something else, but what's that autopilot response?
Nancy, I've sort of noticed that sometimes when I'm under stress, I'm in one slot.
Uh-huh.
And when I'm normal, when things are okay, I'm in a different
slot. So I'm asking you to think more about what goes on autopilot when things are not the way you necessarily want them to be. Okay? Yeah. All right, so that's one triad. The other triad is the harmonic triad. What do we do to make harmony? What do we do to bring harmony to our life, to our situation, to what's going on inside of our head or our heart or our gut? Do we have a positive outlook on things when they're not where we want them to be, when there's conflict and difficulty and we want to bring harmony? Do we have a positive outlook? This is going to be all right. Do we have a competent outlook? I can fix this. Or do we have kind of a reactive, expressive response? And you'll get that in a minute. Do we react and express ourselves rather than when it's difficult and conflicted? So if you have a positive outlook, you probably reframe disappointments in a positive way. It'll be okay. It should have been that way anyway. I'm not worried about it. Everything will turn out all right, because you don't want to deal with pain or negativity in yourself or in other people. So you're just going to look on the bright side of life. And everything's going to be all right. Positive outlook. Competent outlook. You put aside your personal feelings. You want to be objective and effective. You don't want your feelings, your emotions, to get in the way of you finding harmony in this situation. You have a difficulty working in a structure or a system because you expect others to deal with problems logically. And you know what? Sometimes they don't. So you'd rather maybe even work on your own than have to work on a team, because they're just not going to get it like you do, okay? Because you're competent and you can make it happen. You can do it. You can bring harmony to this situation. And the reactive, expressive, see, it can be Rush Limbaugh, but it can also be Diana. So, you know, you tend to react emotionally, not necessarily, you know, screaming and yelling. Maybe just emotionally touched by and moved by a situation. And you look for an emotional response from others. Unlike the first guy who didn't want you to have emotions because that wasn't competent, you look for others to show emotion. And it bothers you if they don't. You have strong likes and dislikes. And sometimes you may play the victim. Oh, woe is me. Or you may victimize others. Or you may do a little bit of both. We each do one of those more than the other. Doris Day, Jimmy Buffett, Kevin Costner, tend to be people that we think of having a positive outlook. Competent people, Charles Darwin, John Calvin, he was very competent, and if you didn't think he was, you got in a lot of trouble. You didn't want to not think John Calvin was competent or right. Vanessa Williams, a reactive, expressive, Angelina Jolie, Mel Gibson, Saddam Hussein. I don't know if Mel Gibson and Angelina would like him being in their category with them, but you know, it's life, that's how it is. That's what I said. Two people can behave different, behave the same from the same number, right? So which are you? Hold that thought. Okay, so we'll put it all together. There's three Hornavian styles: assertive, dutiful, and withdrawn. There's three harmonic styles: positive, competent, and reactive. Think about which one are you in the Hornavian and which one are you in the harmonic. Most of the time, possibly in new or stressful situations. Got it? Got it? Okay. So find yourself on the chart. The Hornavians are across the top and the harmonics are down the side. Find your number where the two intersect. So if you are withdrawn, Hornavian style, and competent, you're probably a 5. If you're withdrawn and positive, you're probably a 9. If you're withdrawn and expressive reactive, you're probably a 4. If you tend to be dutiful and compliant and competent, you're probably a 1. If you tend to be dutiful, compliant, and you're positive, you probably are a 2. You could be. If you're dutiful, compliant, and reactive, expressive, you might be a 6. Assertive and competent, you might be a 3. Assertive and positive, you might be a 7. Assertive and reactive, expressive, you might be an 8. So this may give you just a little hint as to what number you might be. It might be all wrong, but it might give you a hint as to where you might want to think about where you are. Everybody find themselves on there? Maybe you thought you were a little competent and a little positive, but you're always withdrawn, so maybe you're a 5 or a 9. You could be either, you know? Or if you're always competent, but sometimes you're withdrawn and sometimes you're assertive, well, you could possibly be a 3. Or maybe sometimes you're dutiful, so you could be a 1. So it's all over, you could be all over the lot, but it might help you narrow it down a little bit to what you might be. Questions? Thoughts? We're doing good. Okay. That's where we want to stop today. So let me give you the answers to that 30-second test. So get your papers out again. And you might want to write these down so you can refer to it later. So the description of the person in A is the description of an 8. The description of B describes possibly a 3. C describes how a 7 might be. D describes a 6. E describes a 9. F describes a 4. G describes a 2. H describes a 1, and I describes a 5. So I would be curious to hear from some of you in the next few minutes that we have left before we have to go. Did anybody come out in both the chart and the 30-second quiz in about the same place? Yes? Yes? I see a couple of hands. Other people come out totally different? It's okay. Yeah, all right. Does one sound more like you than the other? If you've been dealing with the Enneagram for a while, are these numbers that you've been juggling back and forth and trying to figure out for a long time, or is it something brand new? Brand new, Anne says, brand new. Okay, all right. And next week we're going to go through yet another triad, which is the heart, the head, and the gut. And we'll be looking at those that way of also experiencing. Do we think about things? first? Is that our first response to things? I think it out. Do I feel it in my heart? Do my emotions guide me? Or do I get a gut feeling about stuff? I just walk in a room and I say, ugh, this isn't good. Because my gut says, get out of here. Okay? Those are three ways. And again, there's three numbers in each of those triads as well. And we'll go through those next week and we'll start to go through each number within those triads. So there's plenty of time to figure out your number. But maybe these two ways of doing it gave you some clues. Questions, comments, thoughts, please. Tell me what you're thinking. What are you not sure about? What do you want to know more about? What did I leave you confused about? Pam?
Well, I think that I feel tired. I had no trouble whatsoever sitting here doing it.
Okay. Which means either you needed a nap or you, or that's what you do. Yeah, yeah. If you're a person that just likes to sit and not think, what I meant to say, if you do a lot of centering prayer or mindfulness, then that may have come very easy for you. May not have come easy for you when you first started to learn mindfulness or started to do centering prayer. It may have been a struggle, but now if you're used to it, that 30 seconds may have just gone by so fast you wanted 30 more or 20 minutes because that's what you do every day. So that may not have been a good quiz to help you get at your discomfort levels, okay? But for somebody else who for 30 seconds, that was like a year being quiet and, you know, you don't like silence, then that may have brought up some other feelings for you. And then maybe these two ways of looking at things are better. There are tons of tests online. Some of them are free. Feel free to take them. They're as good as your answers. How honest you are, how brutal you are with yourself. I would also suggest for those of us who are a little bit older that we try to think back to when we were 25 and answer from that point of view. Because if you're doing those quizzes from where you are now and you're my age, you hopefully have developed some better coping skills and you're not quite as raw as you might have been at 25 when you were entering the world for the first time. And that's probably more of your style. And now you've learned how to integrate other styles because you've gotten older and wiser. So try to think back to when you were 25 if you do any of those quizzes online. The best way to learn your Enneagram number is to study the numbers and think about it and try them out to see which one fits. And like I said before, the one that fits is probably the one that makes you squirm a little bit because it's probably the one that you just assume not be, but you are. And that's maybe bad news, good news, but that's how it tends to work. I know I'd rather be anything but what my number is. Although other people say, but I want to be that number. It's so nice. But you don't know that number like I know that number, right? And you'll say the same thing about yours. If you only knew, you wouldn't want to be that number. And then other people will say, well, I'm that number too, and I don't act like you at all. And that's true too. And we'll see why. There's wings, and there's arrows, and there's levels, and there's other things that go into it so that there's tons of permutations of each of these numbers. So we're not all alike. We're not all being put in a box. Okay, so I hope you hear that right from the beginning. We're just beginning to scratch the surface of what this can all mean. Okay? All right, well, I'm going to close.